Well, it is great to be back with you guys. Remember me? I didn't say it for that. I really, really missed you guys. It's good to be back. My family and I, we spent the past 3 weeks kind of on an extended time off, recharge. There was some vacation in there. There was some really, really great family time, some good memories for sure. But I just want to say thank you for your support, just being behind us in that. It really does mean a lot to me and to us. I've noticed that the past 3 or 4 summers, I've tended to kind of plow through the summer, just, you know, week after week after week, and then what happens is I get to August or September, and everyone's coming back from vacation and traveling, and students are coming back, and everybody's like this general sense of, like, a new season, let's do this, you know, we're ready to go, and I'm like, I'm tired, and I'm like, I need a break, and so we just tried to preempt that a little bit and just take some time to re-energize and to kind of be ready for this next season as things pick up around here. And I just want to say, I'm ready to go. So here we go. Well, we are having a family Sunday today. By that, the elementary age kids are with us in the service. And so I thought we would take a break today from the 13 letter series that we've been doing, the letters of Paul, simply because we've been covering so much ground with that each week. And so I just want to hit pause on that and do something that's a little more accessible for everyone, the kids who are joining us. And I will still use my grown-up voice, though. I hope that's okay. you picked up on the theme of that song. I'm going to stand my ground. And all summer long, the kids have been exploring this theme of standing up for their convictions. And we're going to look at a story from the Old Testament, the life of Daniel here. This morning, it's a story, the character they've been studying as well this summer. And so kids, you guys are ahead of all of us adults, and we're just going to catch up with you on this morning. So if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn with me to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel 1 will begin there. And as you're turning there or pulling that up on your phone, let me just give you a little bit of context for what's going on here so that we kind of know what's going on when we read. Around 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, he attacked Jerusalem, which is in the larger province of Judah. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it." And so what this means, the temple was destroyed, the walls were broken down, you know, Jerusalem was seized. This means that worship and daily life, Judaism, basically came to a grinding halt in Jerusalem, in the country of Judah. Verse 2, it says, "And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand," Nebuchadnezzar, "along with some of the articles of the temple of God." And so it's kind of a strange statement there if you think about it. And there is a backstory, there's a subplot here, and that's this. God had repeatedly warned the people of Judah and Jerusalem that if they weren't faithful to him, that there would be consequences, that there would be punishment, there would be judgment. And so that's kind of what's behind this. I know it's a little bit strange, and perhaps to some of us that seems kind of harsh. The Lord delivered Jehoiakim into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. But I just want to point out, as you read through the various places this comes up throughout the Old Testament, the point of God's judgment, the point of this whole thing is always to bring people back to him. God's always trying to draw people to himself. It just so happens that many times these people are stubborn and they refuse to change and they refuse to do the right thing and basically have to learn the hard way. And I know none of us can relate to that at all. So that's the story of largely the Old Testament. Now, one of the things that Nebuchadnezzar would do when he conquered a people is he would go and he would take the gods, the idols of that conquered people, he'd haul them back to Babylon and he'd place them in the temple of one of the main gods, a god named Marduk. And so he placed all these idols, these statues, in Marduk's temple, kind of like a museum. You know, kind of like, you know, these are all of my trophies. And the statement that he was making very clearly was, our god Marduk is superior, right? Because we conquered these people, and their inferior gods couldn't protect them. And so, you know, you see these rows and rows of these idols from other countries and nations and religions. And it was just their way of saying Marduk is obviously the best. Verse 2. Still in verse 2, actually. "The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand." Here's an interesting detail. "Along with some of the articles from the temple of God." See, this means that when Nebuchadnezzar, you know, went into the temple in Jerusalem, he was probably a bit confused because for the first time in his life, he's encountered a people who don't have any idols for him to take back home. And this is because, of course, God had commanded them, you know, not to make idols, graven images. It's the first of the Big Ten. It's the first of the Ten Commandments. And so as a result, there are no idols when Nebuchadnezzar and his people go into the temple. And so they walk in, they look around, they can't find any idols. All they can find is like some furniture and some, you know, candle holders and some crock pots and, you know, stuff like that. And he's like, huh, this is weird. But I guess this stuff will just have to do. And so he takes it and he takes it back to Babylon. Second part of verse 2. These he carried off to the temple of his god, Marduk, in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his god. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was pretty ruthless, but he was also a smart guy. And so instead of just killing people or enslaving them, which he did do that too, he had an additional strategy he layered on top of that approach, and that's this. He would find the best and the brightest from among the people that he conquered, and he would bring them back to Babylon. He'd basically bring them back to his home and turn them into Babylonians. So he'd go into a nation he conquered, he'd find the people he thought, these are the people with the most potential. These are the people who are like the cultural influencers, the thought leaders in their little environment. I'll bring them back and to this major cosmopolitan city, and I'll kind of transform them. And so Nebuchadnezzar would then teach them the language of Babylon, the customs. He'd give them, as we'll see, new names. They were put into a reconditioning program. And once they were fully integrated into the ways and the cultures of Babylon, they were then put into the king's service. And so, again, he surrounded himself with the best, the brightest, the most attractive people he could find. And Daniel, whom this book is named after, is one of the guys that Nebuchadnezzar and his people pick to take back to Babylon to serve in the king's palace. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't know who Daniel even was. So, verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, so this is the king's like right-hand guy, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. So these are guys, it says, they have aptitude for every kind of learning. They pick up on things quickly. They're well-informed. These are the guys who are good-looking and athletic and got, like, perfect on their SATs. You guys know anybody like that? Right? And you kind of hate them, right? It's like, it's not fair. So Ashpenaz, again, selects these young men to serve in the king's court. It says he was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. So they go through this whole 3-year kind of makeover, extreme makeover process, and just to prepare them to work and to serve in the royal house. Now, just pause for a second. If you think about this, this is a huge break for these guys who were chosen, right? I mean, for everyone else, the rest of the people, the poor, the uneducated, guess where they are? They're back in Judah. They're back in Jerusalem, which is now a vassal state of Babylon, which means that everyone works and works and works and farms the land and gives most of the money back to Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. That resulted in extreme poverty for the majority of the people back home. And so here's the deal. If you survived the battle, and if you weren't taken back to Babylon to be one of the slaves of the wealthy elite, things are really rough for you. There's not a lot of options back in Judah and Jerusalem. If you think about it this way, these guys' families, they're either dead or they're going to have it really, really rough from here on out. And so Daniel and these other young men, they are surrounded by luxury that they probably couldn't even believe, that they never would have had back home. This is as good as it gets, and they won the lottery with this. It says that they're given a daily amount of food from the king's table. We kind of miss this. In that culture, it was kind of a big deal. Like, the goal was to eat like one meal a day. I mean, if you did that, you're doing pretty well. I mean, much of daily life revolved around getting enough food enough food to eat. And so you actually see this with Jesus centuries later when he teaches his disciples to pray, give us this day, today, our daily bread. Like that was literal for them back then. And so here's Daniel realizing he's never going to have to worry about food again. And for sure, it's the best food in the whole country, obviously. Probably even the whole world at the time. He's going to be in this training program for 3 years, which means for 3 years, they'll have everything that they need. They're going to live in and around the palace, which that's not too bad. The end of this 3 years, they're going to be brought before the king, and he's going to look them over and say, you know, do some push-ups and here's some quizzes. And, you know, the top of the class then goes on to serve in the king's palace. And if you're selected for that, you're set for life. You're going to be well taken care of. Verse 6, among those chosen were some from Judah. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so some men from Judah were chosen, were given four names. This, by the way, implies that there were some other people chosen, probably from some other peoples that Nebuchadnezzar conquered, like on his warpath. If you're in Daniel's shoes, you're having kind of some mixed feelings, right? Because your people have been conquered, right? Your people are suffering. You know, you're wondering, you're in Babylon, in the palace, wondering, what's happened to my family back home in Judah? But for Daniel, at the same time, and these select few guys, this is an unbelievable turn of events. This is as good as it can possibly get. The best case scenario for them. Verse 7, it says, the chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. So Ashpenaz gives them these new Babylonian names. Daniel's given the name Belteshazzar, and I'm sure he's like, really? From Sunday school, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the whole fiery furnace, that happens later in the book of Daniel. The encounter, the thing with the lion's den, that comes up later as well. But here's where it gets interesting. Knowing this context, and the writer of Daniel would have assumed that we knew all this background and kind of this tension that these young men are faced, you know, in this kind of new situation. It's as good as it gets, but it's bad for everyone else. Knowing all this, the writer here does a brilliant job, I think, of kind of drawing us into this major point of tension in this first chapter in Daniel's story. The next verse, verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now think about it. The other guys are probably going, look at this. This is incredible. And yet for Daniel, there's something in him that says, no, I'm not going to eat that food. I'm not going to drink that wine. And we don't exactly know all the details here on why does Daniel choose to draw the line, you know, so defiantly on this issue. But most scholars agree that there are some things probably going on. First of all, the food most likely wasn't kosher, meaning that Nebuchadnezzar was serving things, I don't know, pork, shellfish, things that the Jews were forbidden to eat according to their custom and their belief and their tradition. On top of that, Daniel knew that before the food was served to the king, it was first offered to Marduk. In other words, they would bring the food in to an idol, before an idol of Marduk, and say, here, great and mighty Marduk, you eat all that you want. Eat until you are fully satisfied, and then after you're satisfied, then we'll eat. Which worked out pretty well most of the time because it's made of stone and you didn't eat all that much, and so that was a good deal. But for Daniel, what we do know is for sure is that this went against everything he believes. It's offensive. I mean, the way it's prepared, the meaning behind it, it's contrary to everything Daniel believes about this one true God that he serves. And I imagine for Daniel, it would sort of be like eating dinner with Marduk every night was sort of how that felt to him. And so Daniel, in his heart, resolves not to eat the food. So Daniel decides he's going to go to Ashpenaz, the chief's, you know, the king's advisor, and say, listen, got a little bit of a problem. See, I can't, in good conscience, eat this food that the king has so generously provided. I mean, you realize for Daniel to even bring that up, that's crazy. I mean, maybe people around him are reminding him, Daniel, there are thousands of Jews back home who are starving to death, and here we are, we've been lucky enough to be chosen and in this place, and you know, I know your conscience and whatever, but here we are. Think how lucky we've been. And perhaps they're saying things like, Daniel, look at this look at this influence that we've been given. Look at the position that we've been given in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. I mean, if we try to stay on his good side and don't do anything to like provoke him, I mean, we might be able to influence him down the road, and think of what we could do, all the good from this place. And so there are all kinds of reasons for Nebuchadnezzar for Daniel to make a little compromise. Remember that there are other people from other young men chosen from other countries. I mean, perhaps you have them also saying things like, think about from the beginning of the story. Daniel, let me get this straight. Your concern is being faithful to God, and this is the God who, the text says, was the one who apparently allowed the Babylonians to overrun the walls of your city and to tear down the temple and to kill your people, maybe even your relatives. Your main concern at this point is to be faithful to a God who allowed that. Or maybe they said, Daniel, it's made of stone. Who cares? It's not real. Or, you know, who cares where the food was prepared or the meaning behind it or what it stands for? It doesn't get better than this for guys like us. I think the real implication is this, Daniel, this might be the end of your life if you go through with this. Because when you tell Ashpenaz what you've decided to do, Ashpenaz is probably not going to say, well, look here, a man of deep conviction. Nebuchadnezzar loves it when people, he thinks it's kind of cute and kind of charming when people don't do what he asked them to do. We applaud that here in the world of Nebuchadnezzar. No. Now, let's just be honest. If you are in Daniel's shoes, it doesn't take a whole lot of effort to find a way in your mind to just go along with this, does it? Not at all. To find reasons to downplay the whole thing. After all, it's just food. And I don't want to come across as rude and ungrateful, and aren't we supposed to submit to, you know, like the authorities, and everyone else seems to think it's okay, and these are unusual circumstances and trying times, and you know, you could go on and on. If you're Daniel, how easy, just think about this, how easy is it for you to talk yourself into just going along with this? See, knowing myself as I do, I'm not sure that I would have made the same decision or had the same resolve as Daniel. But Daniel's dilemma is a lot like our real lives, isn't it? Because for most of us, the things that we are faced with on a daily basis aren't these huge, glaring temptations, these huge, big compromises. What we encounter on a regular basis is plenty of gray areas, like decisions where the lines aren't exactly clear, and even if they are a little bit clear, we can make them blurry if we want to. We have things where the people around us, you know, nobody thinks it's a big deal. Everyone's just kind of going along with this. And the general tenor is stop being so uptight and just relax. We've all bumped up against this tension. We've all experienced this tension of here's who I want to become. Here's what I want with my life, what I want my life to be about. But yet, to get that, to accomplish that, I'm going to have to do some things that maybe I don't think are quite right. I'm going to be tempted to take a shortcut. And I know that in the moment, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. It's like no major thing, no sirens going off, no, you know, nothing blaring like that. And we look around and we realize I wouldn't be the only one, for sure. I'm going to think of all these loopholes and all these workarounds. But you and I, we've all been in these situations, haven't we? We've been in these situations where there's something in our conscience that rises up, and it's not a shout, and all you have to do is go, shh, and it's done, right? It goes away. Some of you are in a situation right now where you're making a business decision, and you had that little whisper, and you've shushed it, right? But here's how you know there's a tension. If you were to have to share that with a spouse or a close friend outside the situation, yeah, I don't want to do that. Well, why not? Because I know what they're going to say. Some of you have made, you know, weekend plans, or you've done certain things, and in your mind it's like this is okay. I got this. This is on the right path. And yet, if somebody were to say to you, well, would you share that with your family, your parents? No, I don't want to do that. You see, there's a thing within us, and we know it when we're doing this. For some of us, it's like here are the people I would like to include me, to be accepted by. There's this group at school, there's this group at work that I want to be a part of, and here's what success looks like, and I want to get there as quickly as I can. But to do that, I'm going to have to take a shortcut somewhere. I'm going to have to compromise somewhere along the way. I'm going to have to play a game, a mental game, and violate my conscience. I'm going to have to say no to my convictions, my heart, my values in order to get where I want to go. At the end of the day, I'm going to have to betray myself. And here's Daniel. And what does Daniel say? You can cut my hair if you want. You can give me new clothes and I'll learn your language and I'll read your books, but that's it. See, what does Daniel realize that I think sometimes many of us forget? I think Daniel recognizes what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do. What Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do is over time slowly erode the values and the things that were important to the people he captured, including who their God was. Nebuchadnezzar's whole plan was that not tomorrow, not the next day, but months from now, years from now, guys like Daniel would wake up and be like, all right, I'm basically Babylonian in pretty much every way, and fully embracing that culture and letting go of these other things, including God, and leaving that behind. So Daniel says, I'm not going to eat your meat. I'm not going to drink your wine. That's as far as I'm going to go. I'm not going to violate my conscience, even though my life may depend on it, and for sure my livelihood does depend on it. Daniel made up his mind. I will not compromise my values, regardless of the consequences, regardless of what's dangled out in front of me. And to do that, like in the moment, to do that when you're the only person standing your ground like that, when everyone else is going another way, to do that when no one is watching, to do that when there are potentially negative consequences, that takes some real inner character, doesn't it? It takes some real inner character and fortitude. That's exactly what Daniel does. And you got to admire him for it. I wonder how many of us would pass that test? Verse 9. Now God. Oh yeah, kind of forgot about him for just a minute there, because I was really focused on what was dangled in front of me and the consequences and what might happen, and I forgot to factor God into the equation. Oh yeah, God. God is still in the picture. See, what Daniel did, he decided, I can fear Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom and this whole system that I'm caught up in, or I can fear and trust God, who really ultimately controls my destiny. Verse 9, the whole thing. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. So Daniel goes to Ashpenaz, broken, you know, Babylonian, explains the whole situation. And Ashpenaz is like, look, Daniel, I like you. Like, you're a good guy. I really do. And I'd love to be able to help. But listen, somebody's going to lose their head because of this. And it's not going to be me. So sorry, I can't let you do that. And we don't have all the details, but apparently Daniel, he's not going to give up. Verse 11. Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. So Daniel somehow convinced one of the guards, and the guard says, here's your vegetables, here's your water. It didn't come from me, you know, good luck. Verse 15, at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So at the end of the 10 days, God blessed them. The experiment worked. Nebuchadnezzar realized, hey, maybe all this like red meat and wine that I've been having for like breakfast, maybe that's not the best. Verse 16, so the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. And all of Daniel's buddies were like, thank you, Daniel, for that. Awesome. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. So to these four men, God gave wisdom. He gave them understanding. Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. After 3 years, they graduated at the top of their class. And Nebuchadnezzar recognizes there's something special about these guys. And so he elevates them to the highest levels of leadership in his whole kingdom. And Daniel, especially Daniel, draws Nebuchadnezzar's attention. He begins to gain more influence with him. And not only with this king, but as you read throughout the book of Daniel, even the kings who follow. I would argue as you read through Daniel that this event, this decision, puts Daniel on ultimately the course and the path that he moves throughout the rest of his life and the things that happen to him. Here's the thing about Daniel for us. He was smart, you know, he was good looking. He could interpret dreams, whatever, right? But none of those things are what got him where he ended up. He got there because he decided that no matter what, he wasn't going to take any shortcuts. He made the decision that he was going to trust God, he was going to honor God, that he wasn't going to fear Nebuchadnezzar, who claimed to be in control of all these things. He feared God. And I think one of the things that's most compelling to me about Daniel's story is the fact that he makes this decision to stand up for what he believes in, to stand up for what's right. You realize he makes that decision before or after he finds out what's going to happen. Obviously before. Right? He doesn't know when he goes to Ashpenaz, who then goes to Nebuchadnezzar. He has no idea what the consequences are going to be. It's probably not going to be good. Of course, Daniel hasn't read the book of Daniel. Right? He has no idea that thousands of years from now we're going to be telling a story from that point. He has no idea that people are going to like name their kids after him. See, if he could have known in that moment what was going to happen, that would have been a lot easier. Right? He would have been a whole lot more confident. If you or I were in Daniel's shoes and God showed us like the whole future, we would have been probably kind of cocky about it, right? Like, listen, Nebby Nebs. That's my nickname. I'm not going to drink your wine. I'm not going to eat your food because I'm Daniel. And the only reason people are going to know about you thousands of years from now is because you're going to be a little character in my big, awesome story. But that's not how life works, is it? We don't get that ahead of time. See, this means deciding ahead of time who I'm going to be, the values and the things that are important to me, the decisions and how I'm going to make those decisions. It means deciding, like, right now, not in the moment. In the moment is too late. I'm not going to compromise even on the little things. Because I've done that before, and you know what happens? Not immediately, but over time, I begin to drift away from God. And I don't want to fall into that. I don't want to wake up months from now, years from now, far, far away from God, wondering, how in the world did I get here? And you know what? It might not work out. And I might not get the promotion. And maybe it means I don't get ahead and I don't get accepted by the little group. And perhaps I make less money than I could have otherwise. And maybe it means even a setback. But I will be able to go to sleep at night and have peace, knowing that in my heart, in my soul, that things are well. It means deciding like Daniel. I'm going to focus on my character and the decisions that I make, and I'm going to let God take care of the success and the money and the friends and the promotion and the applause and all that. I'll let God take care of that. Because that's what true greatness is. And let me just tell you, that is so, so rare. I can't promise if you do this that things will work out for you like they did for Daniel. They might not. But I do know that trading in your character, like betraying your convictions, it's never worth it in the end. Your character is the only thing that you and I have that cannot be taken from us. It can only be given away willfully, eroded a little bit at a time. I want to invite the band to come on back up. We're going to close with a song here in just a minute. Just a last thought here. You know, the kids have been learning about this throughout the summer. But I think it's true that no matter what stage of life that you're in, that this continues to show up. It shows up when you're trying to achieve success, when you're trying to accomplish what you want to accomplish. And guess what? It shows up after you've done it, because then you got to stay there. And so you'd be tempted to take shortcuts, tempted to compromise. This shows up in lots of different ways. We all have opportunities dangled in front of us from time to time. And what many of us have discovered is that the most direct way, the most direct route to what we want in life, it's rarely the right thing. You realize it takes a lot of courage to live like this, right? Especially if this means implementing this in areas where perhaps you haven't been in the past. Because what's going to happen is, as sure as you make this decision, your friend's going to say, but hold on, like you've always done it this way. What are you doing? You're going to have somebody at work, a coworker, say, come on, don't be ridiculous. It's just business. For some of us, it's going to mean saying, in those moments, look, I know. I know my track record. I know what I did the last time. I realize that my reputation is working against me. But for once in my life, I'm not going to take a shortcut. For once, I'm going to do the right thing the right way. I'm not going to compromise. Look, I'm trying to keep the wheels on this thing, okay? And it may mean less stuff, but I'll have more peace. And it may mean, you know, people think I'm a fool, but I will be able to lay my head on my pillow at night and have peace. So it means making this decision that I'm not going to abandon God. I'm not going to abandon what's right for the sake of a promotion or success or inclusion or advancement. Because I want to tell a better story than that. Don't you? So I say, bring it. Bring it. Would you stand with me? We'll pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the life of Daniel, the story in Scripture, the inspiration that he is to us. Lord, for those of us right now in the middle of a decision or a dilemma of some kind, and it would be so easy for us, and we know it, we've already done the workarounds, we've done the calculations, we've figured out it's not going to be a big deal. We can deny our conscience, we can say no to our conviction. Or we can choose another path. We can stand up for our values. We can stand up for what we know is right. We can follow through with it regardless of the consequence. Lord, help us. Lord, for those of us here who we're trying to change, trying to get on a new path, but we have, just because of our past, we've got a series of decisions in the wrong direction, and we've got momentum there as well. Lord, I pray that you would give us the courage and the strength to start new. When people challenge us, when old friends come around, when people at work, you know, remind us of what we did in the past or who we used to be, I just pray that you would give us the courage to start new, to do what we believe is right, to honor you. Lord, help us to be more worried about honoring you and what you think of us than we are of what anyone else thinks. May we honor you with everything that we do, everything that we say, with all of our lives. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.